Welcome to another edition of On Mic with Jordan Rich, featuring conversations with voiceover artists, actors, producers, authors, and those involved in the act of performance. Now today, a little departure of sorts to spend some time with an old friend, celebrated movie writer John DeLeo, who first penned And You Thought You Knew Classic Movies back in 1999. Since then, other terrific books include 100 Great Film Performances You Should Remember But Probably Don't, Screensavers, 40 Remarkable Movies Awaiting Rediscovery, and John's most recent that we'll talk about today, 10 Movies at a Time, a 350-film journey through Hollywood and America, 1930 to 1970. And it's certainly appropriate that we talk with John about the advent of talkies in the late 20s when sound became the revolution in film. And this is where his latest book begins. You'll definitely want to check out his site as well, johndeleo.com. That's D-I-L-E-O, johndeleo.com. To lose yourself in a celluloid world filled with wonder, scandal, excitement, and lots of surprises. So let's welcome now John DeLeo, an old friend, somebody we did a lot of radio with over the years, and it's great to have you on the podcast, John. Welcome back.
Oh, it's so good to talk to you again, Jordan. I'm really happy about it.
Nice to see that you're still at it and more of a wonk, and I mean that in the loving way, more of a movie wonk than ever. The detail in 10 movies at a time is just amazing, I got to tell you.
Yeah, well, it was a labor of love, and I guess I did kind of pour everything I've got inside that I wanted to say into this one. It's sort of my epic, I'd say.
Well, it is so detailed, and what I love about it is through the movies, and there are 350 films represented here, through the movies, we get a sense of the history of the country and the culture, going back to the pre-code, post-code era, the World War II era. Why did you come up with this concept? What prompted you to do this 10 movies at a time concept?
I guess because, you know, any movie you watch, in terms of the societal aspect, even, you know, if it's a very trivial, you know, even a black and white musical from the 40s, say, you always get a feeling of the time in which it was made. Something about it, it makes you feel like you're closer to the era, like I said, in which it was concocted. And I guess that is sort of why I wanted to talk about these movies in clusters of when they were made and what was going on both in the country and in the industry. And so every time I could think of, say, 10 examples of something, I thought that was enough to qualify as a certain kind of trend or something that could be worthy of a discussion. And so, as you said, every chapter deals with 10 movies that are in some way connected by the time, by a genre, by something in the country. And through the course of writing it, I really found I made discoveries for myself. I had an idea of what I wanted to try to do at the beginning of a chapter, and then through the writing of it, I felt like I learned a lot just by looking at movies and comparing them and seeing that certain things are happening at the same time over and over again.
10 movies at a time, a 350-film journey through Hollywood and America, 1930 to 1970. And if I can just ask you to talk about the early 30s, I think it's a fascinating time because, and I'll have you explain what the code means in a second, but it's really a wild west, if I can use that term loosely, of movie making with a lot of risque stuff that people today think, how did they get away with it back then? Talk a little bit about the early chapters in the book.
Yeah, well, I wanted to essentially, the book is my kind of idiosyncratic history of the golden age of Hollywood, the rise, the peak, and the decline. And the rise, of course, happens with the dawn of talking pictures, which, you know, essentially kicks off in 1927 with The Jazz Singer, but really gets rolling in 29, and then we're, you know, into the early 30s, the early talkies. But, of course, this coincides, too, with the stock market crash. So you've got this incredible moment of forward-moving technological advances. At the same time, the whole country has, you know, gone way down. And so it's a very interesting moment. Yeah. And what you're referring to in terms of the risque aspect of this, Hollywood was always dealing with censorship or fighting censorship. There were always watchdog groups who were appalled by what was happening, not just on the screen, but the behavior of the stars that was reported in tabloids. So through the height of the 20s, you know, all that sort of behavior on screen and off was driving certain people crazy. And what Hollywood did, they were terrified that the government would come in and control things. So they created the production code, and it would be self-enforced. So So they created in 1930 to shut everybody up, and then they don't pay attention to it. It was just a lip service thing.
Yeah.
But things get much worse in terms of people pushing what they're getting away with, and most notably the movies of Mae West. And so in 1934, it becomes enforced, and then for the next 30 years, we have what we call old movies and, you know, married couples and twin beds and all of that. But in those early 30 years, you have a lot of movies about prostitution, a lot of gangster movies which are incredibly violent and kind of scary, and sometimes crime will pay and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes women have children out of wedlock and they're not punished for it the way they would be in a few years. So when people look back on these, they weren't on television for many decades because of how racy they were, and people can't believe they're watching old movies with these elements. And it is a fascinating period that, we call the pre-code era.
And what was interesting to me, and I know a little bit about movies, I don't know a lot about it as you do, is the impact of the female stars back then. Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck, you mentioned Mae West. The female star power, if you will, in terms of their draw, was immense compared to what many people might think.
Yes, much more so back then than in the last, say, 50 years of movies, you know, going back from today. Yes, the female stars were probably more dominant. And like I said, if you were a star in the early 1930s, chances are you played a hooker in something. And one of the chapters in the book, as you know, deals with the transition. Once the code comes in, you have all these women who become famous for certain kinds of parts, and they have to adapt because they're not making those stories anymore. So the most sort of obvious example is someone like Jean Harlow, who had played all kinds of gold diggers, women who set out to steal the boss from his wife and sleep her way to the top, essentially. And suddenly you're not going to be able to make those kinds of movies. So you have to find new ways to stay popular. And a lot of them really did it, and it also coincides with the emergence of screwball comedy. So a lot of those ladies found out they could be funny, and then they extended their careers. Well, that's what you learn about when you're studying movies, is reinvention. That is the key to long careers.
Right.
These people, when we're talking about Joan Crawford or Clark Gable, it's always about finding new ways to stay current, to take what people love about you and finding new ways to fit with how the culture's moving and how times are changing. And not many people can master it, because they say the average successful career for any Hollywood star is 7 years, and anyone who can go beyond 7 years of starring in movies, that is extraordinary.
That matters today as much as it did back then. And you mentioned Gable and folks like him, who, the king of Hollywood. And he had a career that took him right till the end of his life, pretty much. And he became an older sort of stalwart actor, became the father figure for some, and still sexy, sex symbol. But I want to go back to the big events of our time in the 20th century that are so important in the reflection of the movies. And, of course, you mentioned the Depression. And then World War II is the huge upheaval in the world, and what Hollywood does and how it responds is always fascinating. The World War II epic patriotic films, and even those that were downright propaganda for the good guys.
Yeah, it's an incredible moment, because Hollywood doesn't even know its impact at that point. They know they're going to take on the role of morale building, and they've got millions of people coming to the theaters every week. So it's kind of obvious in one sense, but they really take on this morale-building role with such fervor, and it has such an impact. And for anyone who was wondering, well, you know, nobody pays attention to movies, they're just frivolous entertainment, they really served a function. They really kept morale high. They kept people informed in some of the more serious pictures. They kept them sort of distracted with this incredible wave of escapism, of course, in movies with Betty Grable or Rita Hayworth. And sometimes they merge them, which is, there's a chapter in the book on what I call the comic book movies, which is a fascinating hybrid, because there's sometimes, you know, movies about fighting the war, something like Desperate Journey with Errol Flynn and Ronald Reagan, and yet it's sort of done as a comic book adventure, and so you're sort of getting an escapist view of the actual events. And so they're in Germany fighting Nazis, but it's also like a comic book adventure. And it was almost a way to sort of keep people involved, but not give them too much reality.
Right.
The reality comes after the war, And that, as you know, there's a chapter on those movies.
Right.
When the war was over, we knew we had won it, and it's safe to go back and make movies about more complicated issues involving
sure.
the war. I mean, I think specifically something like 12 O'Clock High, which you would never would have made during the war because it's about the incredible psychological toll of commanding people and how you can't let anyone see what's going on inside of you if they're looking to you to tell them what to do.
Mm.
And like I said, no one would want to sit through something like that during 1943. You want to hear about, we're going to win, don't worry, things are tough, the enemy is evil, but we're on it, and don't worry. And they all leave you with a certain
yeah.
amount of optimism. And if it's a little pessimistic, it's supposed to anger you to sort of get a little more revved up about being committed to the fight.
Following chapters, there's one that really hits home, and it's very important because today we're so involved with, quote, sensitivity. It's called Sensitivity Training, 1947 to 1950, when you have films like No Way Out with Sidney Poitier and Richard Widmark and other movies that were daring enough to talk about issues of the day, racism, anti-Semitism, post-war, post-stress, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's sort of like once we won the war, and it's sort of like as, you know, the bombs had been dropped on Japan, news of what actually had happened with the Holocaust, it was a grown-up world, and there was no going back in a certain way of what we'd all learned about what reality, how real reality can be, how startling news events can be. And Hollywood reflected that by sort of growing up and, as you said, embracing some of those issues, also alcoholism, mm. mental illness, mm. you know, things that they might have shied away from previously as being too downbeat. And so there was a new maturity, definitely, that came in the late 40s. But also, there's also a chapter on fantasy films of the same time, which was kind of the antidote to what we just mentioned, because not everyone, of course, is willing to go to the movies to think and grapple with issues. And movies like The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, say, and One Touch of Venus, and Miracle on 34th Street, where it was almost as if I feel Hollywood was saying, but don't worry, if you don't like to go to the movies and think, we haven't, you know, let you down. We're still going to do the thing you love us for. And so how those two types of movies coexisted, you know, that little bit of something for everyone, which they're always, you know, trying to keep as many people happy as possible.
Right.
That's always their aim.
It's not all about serious issues. And one chapter that I found intriguing, of course, and you got to be a movie geek, is the chapter on Clifton Webb, a name that yeah. many young people may not be familiar with. But here's this guy in the middle of all of these superstars and glamorous Hollywood types who comes out and is basically a standout for a certain several reasons. And he has a 20-year career. Tell us about Clifton Webb.
Yeah, look, most of the, like I said, the 35 chapters are about sort of genres and trends and all of that, but three of them are about individuals, and one of them, because it just stood out to me, I thought somebody has to talk about this, is Clifton Webb, who becomes a star at the age of 55 in a movie called Laura, which every classic film buff remembers. And he was what we would call a stereotypical gay man. But because he was middle-aged, I don't think anyone cared about what he may or may not be doing in bed. People embraced him and loved him because of his way with an insult. He was so great with, you know, putting people down in movies, and everyone just loved how witty,
yes.
how sneering he could be. And it was that sort of that vicarious thrill of being that good at putting someone in their place.
Right.
And so for the next, his career went until 1962. He became a surprise box office hit. Of course, he was never a romantic idol, and he played sometimes villains, sometimes he played fathers, like in Cheaper by the Dozen, which was a big hit. But for that era, which we would consider essentially the Eisenhower years, was his big box office time, which is kind of a conservative time, and to have this unmarried star who, as I said, if you were kind of in the know, you would suspect he was a gay man, and you'd be right. Here he is selling a huge, it was sort of like the Liberace equivalent, because they're kind of contemporaries, that nobody sort of went there, as we say.
Yeah, no, I remember him. obviously in Laura and A Night to Remember and all those films, but he was always smoking and always elegant and urbane and would absolutely destroy you with his words.
Well, he became really a superstar when he dumped the bowl of oatmeal on the little boy's head in Sitting Pretty, because, you know, it was sort of, when you hear a baby screaming, will not stop, and is flinging cereal around the room, and he dared to dump the cereal on the child's head and make him quiet, and I think America was both startled and delighted. He sort of had them forever after that moment.
We'll be right back to the program in just a moment. I did want to take time to thank you for listening to On Mic with me, Jordan Rich. You'll find links to my website and Facebook page in the show notes. So I invite you to reach out to me. I'd love to hear your ideas for future shows and guests. Since I've heard you take requests, here's one from me. When you get a moment, I'd love for you to rate and review this podcast in all of the important places we hang out, including Apple, Android, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. It'll go a long way in helping me build this audience up and keep the studio humming with interesting content. And now, back to On Mic with Jordan Rich. Hey, that's me. John, in your work, such great research and such wonderful writing, you probably hear this a lot, because I do, that there are so many ideas that are just being recycled in the Hollywood machine today. It's not anything new. Even in the early days, weren't there roles and plot lines and basic formulaic pieces that were brought up again and again?
Absolutely. It's always been there, and it always will be, because, yes, risk is always the thing everyone's afraid of doing in terms of what they make, in terms of what will the audience like. And of course, the greatest threat to movies in the history of film has been television. And in the book, there is a chapter on this very subject about how in the 1950s, one of the things they did, in addition to widescreen and filming stuff on location and 3D and anything to try to entice you away from the television set, one of the things they did in the 50s was remake a lot of the great films of the 1930s, you know, adding color and right. title tunes and anything. But again, it was that same thing. They loved it 20 years ago. They're going to love it again, just doll it up with what we've got, state
right.
of the art.
Right.
And so, you know, most of them are inferior to the 30s versions, but some of them are even better, like A Star Is Born. So, yeah, I used 10 examples, but I could have gone, you know, to 25 examples easy, because that's where they were going. Like, what do we got? How do we get them back? If you know, mom and dad loved it, the kids are going to love it. Or, you know, grandpa loved it, then, you know, the next generation will too. And you know, it makes perfect sense. And very often it does work. People do respond to the same kinds of things if you sort of doll them up to meet the sort of styles of the current moment.
And as I was reading your book over the last couple of weeks, I did happen to stroll to a movie theater to see one particular film, and I'll tie it in, and I absolutely loved it, and I said, they are absolutely manipulating me into loving this movie. It's called The Greatest Showman with Hugh Jackman. I don't know if you've seen
yeah.
it yet, John.
Yeah.
It is a throwback to the old school movie musical. It's a hackneyed plot based on P.T. Barnum's right. life loosely. But you know what I thought as I was watching it and then reading your book? I thought, God, do I miss the great old days of Hollywood musicals. And you even chart the course of the Hollywood musicals from the late 20s through the 30s, 40s, and they die out. They come back a little bit in the 60s. They die out for several decades, and all of a sudden, I walk into this movie a few weeks ago, and I'm blown away.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the old days.
You're absolutely right, but I love the old movie musicals, too, and you're right. They keep coming back in the book from the early days, pre-42nd Street, when the movie musical is being invented and finding its footing and figuring out what works and what doesn't. And then to the musical biographies, like something like The Greatest Showman, but how they merged with those new serious plots. And
right.
we had things like I'll Cry Tomorrow, which is about the singer Lillian Roth, but it's mostly about her alcoholism. And then, of course, the dying days of the original musicals, those movies with Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly in the late 50s, because of the threat of TV variety and the rise of rock and roll as the pop music of the country, and finally in all those adaptations of the Broadway shows in the 1960s, which essentially becomes what musicals are, again, taking the risk out because everyone already knows the songs to My Fair Lady and The Sound of Music, so the audience is more built in than trying something new. But when you mentioned The Greatest Showman, I saw it, and I thought the same thing. This was a real throwback. because this was like a musical biopic in the Yankee Doodle Dandy
way.
Meaning you don't really learn anything about the person or anything that you believe probably ever happened in the way you see it. It's just a very light framework to hang the tunes and the numbers and the spectacle to give you just enough to hang it together. And I agree, this is very much like a 30s, 40s musical biopic rather than something that came later in the 50s with the sort of realistic details.
Well, you have done something very special here. You've kept me up at night, as you usually do. And this podcast is morphing a little bit from time to time because I can do it. I can have people I really enjoy speaking with back on air, if you will. And we did a ton of shows on WBZ in the late night. But now that we have this platform, it's fun to talk movies with you. And this is absolutely your opus, wouldn't you say? I mean, in terms of detail?
Yes, this is my epic, and I tried to pour everything I could of myself and my movie-going life into it. And when people say, what's your next book, my first thought is it's going to take a while to refill because I really did pour everything I had into this one.
Well, it's called 10 Movies at a Time, a 350-film journey through Hollywood and America by John DeLeo. And please advise people how they can find you on the web, your website, please.
Well, the best way to get the book certainly is Amazon.com. And you can plug in my name, John DeLeo, D-I-L-E-O. And I have an Amazon page with this book and all my other books on one screen. You can see it all. And I do have a website, johndeleo.com, right, as well. And I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all the usual places we're supposed to be in this new world.
Well, you're on this podcast, and I know a lot of people are tuning in and will follow up and order the book. They should, because if you're a movie lover, there's nobody better than John DeLeo. John, a great pleasure reconnecting, and let's continue to reconnect in the future.
Oh, absolutely, Jordan. I enjoyed it so much, as I always have.
You've been listening to On Mic with Jordan Rich, a podcast produced by Chart Productions. Just click the Jordan Rich podcast link at chartproductions.com for more. Please subscribe, download, rate, and review us on Apple and any other podcast platform. Hey, it's great to be with you as always. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific day.